thank you for joining us in today's series of the Tech Talk presentations from the open source and Linux profession. I'm excited to present today's speaker. This is someone who's been around the industry for a while, has made a number of contributions, not to say anything about some fairly interesting presentations at Linux World and elsewhere, but he's got even one larger claim to fame. In addition to being the executive director of the Linux Foundation, Jim Zemlin just happens to be the guy that signs Linus Torvalds' paycheck. Without further ado, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Jim and have him talk to us today about his subject material. Jim?
Thanks a lot, and good morning, everyone. I will try to hopefully be informative. At minimum, I'll try and be mildly entertaining for all of you folks, and I'd like to walk through a relatively brief presentation on where we see Linux moving from the Linux Foundation's perspective, and then spend a good deal of time answering questions that any of you might have about activities that we're working on at the Foundation or broader trends in general related to Linux or open source. One of the things that is really exciting to me in particular this year around Linux is just how vast the influence of Linux is around the globe. For folks at HP, this might not be new news necessarily, given that HP has been one of the earliest and one of the strongest supporters of open source and Linux in the industry, in many ways ahead of your time, using Linux and open source as an underlying platform to deliver interesting and real solutions to customers, and in turn, lots of folks from Hewlett-Packard are contributors to Linux, either through your job or as a hobby that you do part-time. The interesting thing about that work is just how pervasive it is, how interconnected it is to so many different efforts around the globe. One of the things that's interesting about my personal job is I get to travel around, see all of these things, whether it's the one laptop per child being used in Thailand or in countries that have extreme poverty, and being able to see children get excited about being able to communicate with each other and with the greater world, whether it's going to Taipei and seeing the latest consumer electronic devices that are powered by the Linux operating system. Being able to use now in the U.S. a Motorola Razr Linux-based cell phone, being able to boot up Linux on a PS3, knowing that really Linux is just a part of everyday life beyond just server-side computing is incredibly interesting. For this crowd, I don't need to ask the question because I assume most of you use Linux and know you're using Linux, but in many cases, I will ask an audience, if it's a business audience, to raise their hand if they use Linux, and typically I get a small number of people raising their hand who might use a Linux desktop. And then when I ask them if they have a Motorola cell phone or if they've ever logged on to Google or if they've made a trade on the New York Stock Exchange, pretty soon, the entire room is raising their hand, so it's just a great place to be. It's really interesting. The numbers really bear this out. The number of new Linux systems that are being fired up, whether it's on a mobile handset, whether it's on the desktop, whether it's in high-performance computing, the numbers are really impressive. Literally hundreds of millions of new cell phones expected to hit the market over the next several years. 75% of the world's 500 fastest supercomputers run on Linux. Linux on the desktop is seeing, for the first time this year, impressive growth, mainly due to the fact that companies like Hewlett-Packard, your competitors Dell and Lenovo, are now shipping Linux pre-installed on both servers but also on laptops as well. We're seeing a new class of devices emerge on the low end with a recent offering, for example, at Walmart, a $200 green PC run by a Linux-based operating system called GOS. That's been sold out now for a couple of months. Walmart literally can't keep these in the stores. You see new low-cost laptops coming out or small portable devices from companies like Asus that are really going below a, you know, a literally creating a sub, you know, $300, $350 laptop experience for folks. And it's just fascinating to see as more consumer electronics, more manufacturing companies that produce computers or internet devices create new form factors. The one thing they have in common is Linux. In addition, you're seeing entire ecosystems being created around Google's Android platform, for example, or a consortium of mobile handset manufacturers called the Limo Foundation, made up of Samsung, NEC, Motorola, et cetera, all basing their future growth on Linux. Just the numbers are really impressive when you look at the entire size of this market. So the question, when I see all of this and when we see this acceleration in the use of Linux in so many different ways, the question that we should ask ourselves is why? Why is it that Linux is not only growing in server environments, you know, continuing to innovate in areas such as virtualization, high-performance computing, but really also being used in so many different ways and unexpected ways? Why is it that so many of these cases are appearing? And the answer to some degree has to do with the nature of the development process itself. And while this isn't a new concept to any of you, it's worth reflecting on the pace and breadth by which Linux is developed. The breadth is just amazing if you think of the number of unique kernel contributors. Literally, these are folks who are key code contributors to the kernel, 1,700 in the last year, 3,200 in the last 2 years. And those are just people who are submitting code, not people reporting bugs. It's just even a vaster group of that. The speed combined with the breadth of adding 2,000 new lines of code every day, modifying 3,000 lines of code every day, a kernel release roughly every 3 months, a new Linux distribution released on the cutting-edge distros like Ubuntu every 6 months, new enterprise Linux distributions every 18 months. If you think of the speed and the breadth that powers this collective project, it's truly impressive. Market analysts estimate that the R&D that powers Linux is over $1 billion, and each of the market participants tap into that for a far, far smaller amount, making it just an incredibly compelling platform to utilize. So if you think of these fundamental strengths of speed and breadth of collaboration for the project, it's not hard to see why Linux is such a compelling platform. It's really simply a better way to develop software. And when I go around the world and talk to companies, they don't see it as a development methodology so much as an essential component to be competitive. It's amazing. I talked to a Taiwanese manufacturer of mobile devices who said that their time frame for concept to carrier, that is from a design to actually bringing a product into market, into the regulatory requirements for the market, is 6 months. And their comment was that Linux is really one of the only platform that allows them to meet that competitive paradigm because they have access to the source code. They're not dependent on a third-party vendor to modify the code during the manufacturing process to suit that particular device. And they don't have to pay a per-device high royalty, which really makes their products faster to market, and more competitive from a cost perspective. So those are just a few examples of why people are using Linux and why it's so compelling. There's just never before been this effective of a collective work on software. Where we're entering this turning point of people realizing the value of this incredible collective software effort, I think one of the things I'd like to talk with this group today is where are we going from now? What is the next stage of growth for Linux, given that we now have Linux operating in this mainstream, massively collaborative endeavor in a multi-billion dollar market? Where are we going from here? And that's what I'd like to spend the bulk of my time talking about today and answering questions from all of you and hearing some of your comments and hearing some of your suggestions of how we can make Linux better. At the foundation, we really see the future of Linux entering a world that's going to be dominated by two main platforms. And in many ways, being dominated by two concepts, a concept of open and a concept of close. We believe that the future isn't going to be all open, but it's certainly not going to be all closed. And as people continue to realize the benefits of collaboratively developing this type of software, increasingly the world will be more open. But in that world, which is characterized primarily by Linux on the open side and Windows on the proprietary and closed side, I think it's worth being a part of the open community to look at the other side and see what folks do to be more competitive. And it's worth looking at Microsoft at that point as, we can criticize their business model, and I'm certainly not a fan of how they release their software or how they leverage their monopoly position. But it is safe to say that the company is a very successful company. I think many people don't even realize just how successful the company is. When you think about it in sort of simple terms, it's a company that, through their Windows and Office franchise, has a net profit of $12 billion per year. During the course of this talk today, Microsoft will profit several million dollars. I think it's something like $400 a second, thousands of dollars a minute, millions of dollars per hour. It's just an impressively successful platform that's all over the globe and hugely profitable. And while, again, I don't agree with how they develop software and I don't agree with how they leverage their incumbent position, it's worth studying them from the open perspective to see what they've done to be successful, and then how we can, in turn, be more successful as an open community. And this is something that the members of the foundation look at as we enter this ubiquitous stage for Linux and get really, frankly, more competitive with the incumbent proprietary vendors that are out there. Microsoft does three things fairly well in that context. One, they do a very effective job promoting their platform. They spend billions of dollars in desktop server and mobile. They give matching marketing funds to mobile device carriers to advertise their devices along with the Windows mobile platform, and that puts them into that platform in an effective way. It's very safe to say that you've probably seen a Microsoft advertisement or communication within the last week. Microsoft also does a fairly effective job of attacking their competitors. This year, in 2007, we saw a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt created by Microsoft around Linux, particularly around intellectual property, particularly around patent infringement. We really see these not as any kind of meaningful legal risk to the platform, but really more of a competitive paradigm from Microsoft, trying to reduce the pace at which open source is rolled out into corporate settings by giving this sort of aura of risk around it. And that's something that they've done fairly effectively, I would argue. The final thing that Windows does fairly well, and something I want to key in on today as a challenge for Linux, is They have a very wildly successful standard in design for Windows, where application developers know that if they write software to their standard, to the Windows API ABI, that a well-written DOS application will run on XP or Vista today. And consumers know that when they see that Design for Windows brand on a software application, that it's likely to run on any Design for Windows branded laptop, PC, or desktop operating system. And of course, the compromise for Windows users who have that simplistic standard is that there's no choice, that Microsoft really leverages their position to lock people into their platform. And so when we look at that, the question that we ask ourselves is, what can the open source industry do to up their game in this second stage? What can we do looking at our competitors to make the open source and Linux platform more successful? And this is where the Linux Foundation sees its role, is playing a facilitating role amongst our member companies, working with the open source community to meet the challenges of this second stage by promoting, protecting, and standardizing the platform. And this is really the corollary of where our competitors see their greatest strengths. In the case of promoting Linux, well, some of the things that we think can be effective in promoting the platform globally is, one, provide a neutral voice for the industry and Linux Foundation members. Whether that's responding to Microsoft FUD or promoting some of the interesting and new developments around Linux, this is something that we feel is good, so that Linux is seen as a greater movement rather than any single company promoting their wares. The other thing that we think is increasingly important for Linux is providing a forum within which people can collaborate on interesting and meaningful technical issues. As I mentioned earlier, speed is one of the underlying strengths of the open development process. You know, getting new functionality into people's hands is one of the underlying strengths. This year at the Linux Foundation, we've begun a series of what we call our collaboration events to bring together the top kernel maintainers, the key maintainers from the hundreds of open source projects that make up the Linux platform, get them in a room with the technical decision makers at our member companies who are either in product management or in technical positions that rely on the Linux platform, and bring those two groups in with large users of Linux, whether it's from Wall Street banks, large insurance companies or pharmaceutical companies, or even the entertainment industry, to really sort through key technical issues, whether it's on power management, standards, packaging, you name it. What we really feel is the combination of the emailed and IRC sort of internet enabled collaboration, that being able to get people face-to-face several times a year to collaborate on meaningful technical issues and make decisions around those, is something that will further accelerate the speed at which Linux and open source projects develop. And that's something that's useful and really plays to an underlying strength of Linux. So those are things that you can expect from the Linux Foundation next year. And I really think that HP as a company, IBM as a company, and many of your other competitors are also behind this idea of bringing together developers and accelerating this, this time market advantage that Linux really provides. So I think that's an important thing for us to do. At the end of the conversation, I can plug a few of the events that the Linux Foundation is sponsoring next year. Among them, Kernel Summit, some of our collaboration events, Plumbers Conference up in Portland, etc. The other area that the Linux Foundation sees is necessary for the Linux platform and needs to be done collectively as an industry is protecting the platform. Clearly, Microsoft is trying to spread doubt about the platform, but there are other folks that challenge the platform that we collectively need to respond to. For example, you've seen recently in the Acacia lawsuit a patent troll challenging the platform. You know, you see folks committing violations around licenses, et cetera. All of these things call for a either legal or promotional response. And so that's some of the things that we really want to focus the industry on and be useful at the foundation by providing things like, one, providing fellowships for folks such as Linus Torvalds. You know, it's people say that, you know, I'm Linus Torvalds' boss, but, you know, the important thing about Linus is that he be provided a place to do the great work that he does that's neutral. I certainly believe that HP wouldn't be happy if Linus was working for IBM, or Oracle wouldn't be happy if Linus was working for one of their competitors, and so on and so forth. What we do is really provide a place where he can continue to do the phenomenal work he does with the community in an unfettered way that's not subject to the quarterly whims of the market, and in a way that can, everyone can collectively participate and take advantage of. And, you know, doing that for Linus is also symbolic of making sure that the kernel project has a place where they can be afforded protection and they can be provided services to help accelerate the work that they do. Other things that need to be done collectively for the platform are things like managing the Linux trademark, protecting it from people abusing it, providing a legal defense fund should anyone similar to SCO bring a suit against the Linux industry, and then just providing timely information on legal issues and debunking FUD. These are all things that we need to do collectively in order to respond to competitive threats. If we don't do these things, competitors will own that conversation, and Linux adoption will not be as fast as we might like it to be. And then the final thing that I talked about previously as a strength of Windows, albeit at the cost of choice, is standardization. And standardization is something that we think about a lot at the foundation. And when we say standardization, what we really think of is preventing Linux from fragmenting. And I'll spend a few minutes on that today. This is the idea that when developers target a platform, they want to do it at a low cost, and they want to reach the broadest audience of potential customers or users that they possibly can. This is obviously a strength of the Windows platform, in that when you're bringing a new application to the marketplace, you know, the place that you're going to get a massive amount of users is Windows. The Linux community needs to collectively respond to this by making it just as simple for developers and ISVs to target Linux and to be able to have those applications work across the broadest number of Linux distributions possible, whether that's Red Hat and Devel in the enterprise, Ubuntu on the desktop, or regionally Linux distributions such as Asianux, Red Flag, you name it. So part of that effort of standardization at the Linux Foundation is creating a Linux standard base, which defines a core set of common components that developers can expect in any Linux platform, and bring that. The other things that we're doing in terms of standardization is looking at areas where we can improve the platform technically, and it isn't necessarily happening in any individual project. Things like making printing easier on Linux is something that we're doing, working with linuxprinting.org, which we manage and maintain, providing a standard way for devices, printers, when they're plugged into Linux, to be recognized and then to signal out to linuxprinting.org to download the latest driver, install it, and really make the printing experience on Linux superior in many ways to the Windows printing. Other things that we're doing around standardization is meeting industry requirements, working to define how Linux can meet the needs of the telecommunication market in our carrier-grade programs and in the mobile market for our mobile Linux platforms. So this just gives you an idea of not only what the foundation is trying to do, really how our members see the future competitive paradigm requiring a new set of requirements as we enter that market. And the good news is that our organization's collective market capitalization is massive. I talked earlier about the $12 billion a year in net profit that Microsoft kicks off. Well, certainly the collective worth of the companies that you're seeing on this slide provides a good deal of hope that the open and federated model of developing software is backed by a meaningful collection of companies that will be here for years and years to come. So, having given sort of a broad description of where we see the Linux market going, I wanted to talk about a couple of areas that are critical for Linux growth. And as I suggested before, Microsoft has really been successful because they have this rich backward-compatible API across different versions of Windows. And they leverage that standard and their incumbent position to really lock folks into that platform. And what this is, the interesting part about this is open source is supposedly a way to prevent this type of lock-in. The answer to how you get out of being locked into Microsoft is, use open source. And so one of the things that's interesting to observe as I look at Linux is this really true? Can you limit the possibility of lock-in by just using open source alone? And my answer to that is probably not. Open source alone does not guarantee or prevent a person who's using the technology from being locked into any particular vendor or platform for that matter. You know, open source really is a development process, and it's hugely important and hugely beneficial, as I've explained earlier, in time to market and in the breadth of new innovation that can come out of that process. But there are also risks associated with it that doesn't necessarily guarantee freedom. And one of the simplest ways to think about why open source alone isn't a guarantee from lock-in is to ask yourself, if I'm using Linux in a meaningful way, if I'm a typical user in the enterprise of Linux, what would be the cost of change of moving from one version to another or switching from one vendor, or if it's not a vendor, from one open source project to another? And it's this cost of change, albeit you have access to the code, it's the cost of change that can also lock people into a particular vendor or implementation of Linux, because if the cost of change is too high, they'll simply be trapped in. I recently talked to firms on Wall Street that are doing very long Linux to Linux migrations, and they're frankly frustrated with that process because what they thought was a brand promise from Linux to free them from lock-in is really turning out to be less true, as it's quite difficult for them to migrate applications to a different version of Linux because there are differences between those versions, and they would like to stop that from happening. The way this happens is Linux can mutate and fragment over time. What I mean by that is tiny changes in the different libraries that make up Linux, different ways across different versions of Linux of how file hierarchies are laid out, of how packages are installed on the system, can create something like speciation in nature, where genetic information changes subtly over time, almost in an unnoticeable way, until at a certain point a new species is created and they can't mate. And this concept is fairly well illustrated in the difference between, obviously, man and ape, but also in different versions of Unix. Speciation looks a little something like this. You start to see different penguins emerging that can no longer interoperate effectively or run applications across their versions. It's interesting to note that the graphic that you're seeing on this particular slide actually came from a Microsoft advertisement talking about the risk of using Linux in open source and promoting the benefits of the Windows standard and platform. So it's clear that if this were to happen, if we were to allow Linux to fragment, that this idea that you wouldn't necessarily be locked in just because you have the available source code turns out to not really be the case. And you'd really see a dramatic decrease in the network effect of this collaborative development process and in the collective and federated approach in the market to compete with that closed and proprietary world. You'd see less competition. You'd see slower at innovation. I think this is a fairly basic concept for people to understand, but it's actually a tricky thing to solve, and which is as evident by the difficulties that Unix has had in tackling this particular problem. Fortunately, we feel that there's an answer here in a standard, in this case the Linux standard base, that provides a real federated approach to meet this challenge. And we also believe it's different from the Unix days in that machine sales are no longer as closely coupled to the software layer of a particular system. We believe the economics of software have changed fundamentally. That provides us an opportunity to really prevent this fragmentation. And certainly source code availability through open source is something that helps accelerate the standardization process and helps us prevent this type of fragmentation. And when we look at this challenge, we really see that there are three things that the industry needs to hone in on to provide a standard. We need to have an actual specification that defines what someone can expect when targeting a standard-based Linux platform. And that's something that we deliver in the LSB specification. And once you've made that definition, you need to have some way of testing for compliance. And this type of testing is incredibly sophisticated, where you have to test the presence and function of thousands of interfaces that make up the platform. And one of the things that we're developing at the Linux Foundation is that test framework, using and spending actually quite a bit of resources developing this comprehensive test framework that can be seen at linuxtesting.org. The way that you also have to do compliance testing effectively is to provide tools that make it easy for ISVs or distributions to then test for compliance or understand how to write applications in a standard-based way. And this is something that we're looking at accelerating this year at the foundation by providing an easy-to-use automated tool for compliance testing, and also by providing what we're calling the Linux Developer Network, which is a set of guidelines that ISVs can use to very simply target the Linux market. And we believe that's something that will kickstart more applications coming onto the platform and prevent fragmentation over time. And then the final thing that you need is a brand to indicate for users of the platform that particular application or distribution that one is using is written in a standardized way, and the Linux standard-based mark is something that we'll see people increasingly looking towards for compliance with the standards, so that people can be assured that they're not only getting the benefits of the open source development model, but they're also going to be free from any kind of lock-in because they see that standard mark on any type of product or application that they purchase. And we feel like we've got a good shot at it. All the major Linux distributions, Red Hat, Novell, Ubuntu, Debian, Asinux, have all certified to the standard and continue to certify. And we're increasingly seeing application vendors such as SAP, Adobe, Real, MySQL, looking to certify their apps. And this year we expect to see many more coming in and certifying to the standard. So I dove down deep into standardization because I thought for folks at HP this is an interesting thing to think about, and is sort of not necessarily intuitive when people think about open source and this freedom from lock-in. The message that I want to leave all of you folks with is that the work you're doing at HP is not only incredibly interesting and is creating sort of a new era of computing, and causing the industry to compete at increasingly higher levels of innovation because we're sharing the underlying technology that runs large computing systems. But when you work on a power management issue, for example, with a data center customer for HP with Linux, that power management technology often finds itself appearing in places that you might not expect, whether it's in the one laptop per child to keep the battery life working longer, or in a cell phone, or so forth. It's really impressive when you consider that the work that all of you are doing has such a profound impact and such an unexpected impact all across the world. So, one, I want to thank you for all of the work that you're doing, and I want to encourage you to continue that, because it's more than just sort of meeting customers' needs from a technical perspective. It's really being part of a grand movement in technology that I think people will look back on 50 years from now and say, wow, that is when computing really changed, and that's where more and more people had access to technology in new and interesting ways that we never expected back then. So with that, I'd like to open it up to questions. I see that there's a couple in the queue, and Harry, I'm not sure how to do the verbal questions here, but I will defer to you on.
Okay. First off, let me say thank you for the presentation. It was interesting. There are a couple of eyebrow-raising points that you bring up in your presentation, and I see we're going to have some people with follow-on questions. But I'm going to shamelessly take advantage of my position as moderator of this conference to ask mine first. And I haven't bothered posting it on the written questions page, but it's a general topic that has fostered some interesting discussions over the life of the Tux Talk series, and it revolves around software patents. Mm-hmm. How do you, as an individual technologist and as a member of the Linux Foundation, view the whole notion of patenting software?
It's a great question. I get this question a lot, and it's interesting. I look at it in two ways. One, I think the patent system relative to software is a mess. Clearly, if you were to chart out the number of software patents that were filed with the USPTO over the past 15 years, you'd see this massive hockey stick in patents being filed. And if you look closely at the thousands of software patents that have been filed, you would find that many of them are dubious in nature in terms of the quality of those patents and the overlap of those patents with other technology out there. It's also, when you look at the patent system, and I'm speaking specifically to software, it's unclear whether or not patents provide any further incentive for innovation in software, and in fact have an unintended consequence of preventing innovation by really making a landmine of potential litigation, a landmine field, so to speak, for technology developers to walk through as they're creating new and innovative things, worried about whether or not they're infringing on one of the many thousands of patents that have been filed out there that may or may not be of real quality. So what all of this says is the system itself needs to reform. And that's something that, while the Linux Foundation is certainly not a lobbying organization, it's something that almost all of our members can agree upon is something they'd like to see come out of Washington, some sort of software patent reform that will make the system and the number of patents issued around software a far different world than what we have today. I also believe that litigation around patents is something that is somewhat of a tax on the industry that could be, and those dollars spent litigating could be much better spent in developing interesting software. So having said that, having looked at it from the system point of view, I think the other way to look at it is from within the system that we live in today, which is a reality. You know, the reality is that the system hasn't changed. that there are lots of holders of patents out there, and how can we work within that system to benefit our goals of sharing development and protecting the Linux platform. And the good news is that in this world, the Linux platform in particular from a patent perspective is not alone. The members of the foundation and sort of the collective stakeholders in Linux consist of some of the largest patent holders and patent portfolios in the world. So from that perspective, it's a fairly well defensively positioned platform. If you think of it even in the crudest sense of the Cold War, if someone were to launch a patent missile against the Linux platform, I think that they could in kind expect a similar response. And no one, it's in no one's interest to see that type of scenario. The only exception to that rule within the system that we have today are patent trolls. These are essentially legal engineering organizations who go and have no other purpose than to purchase patents and then litigate against companies who have legitimate businesses or software developers who legitimately are using and trying to innovate the technology. And we believe that there are protections that need to be provided to them. We look at organizations like the Open Invention Network as a way to respond to that. There are things like Peer-to-Patent, which is a prior art review program that's an interesting way to do discovery of prior art, to look at when a patent case comes before or challenges the Linux platform, to collectively and sort of in a community sense review those patents together for their validity and to work collectively in defending against those things. We also at the foundation work with Linux, with the USPTO in our Open Sources Prior Art program, which is a way to tag software to make it easier for the USPTO to discover prior art and then improve the quality of patents as they are granted within the system today. So you have to work kind of within the system to solve this problem. You have to work also to look at the system for meaningful reform. So long-winded question response, but it's a complicated topic, and I think it bears thought.
I appreciate the depth of your response, because you said a lot of things in there that I personally am in complete agreement with. And to strain your analogy almost to the breaking point, I don't think any of us is interested in mutually assured litigation.
So, I assure you that you're correct, that nobody's really interested in that. But people are, you know, interested in working within our current legal structure to make sure that Linux remains free. I think the thing that I would have people on the phone communicate is this is a well-protected, multi-billion-dollar platform from an industry perspective, and there is little fear from a user of the platform that any kind of legal problem would pose any more significant risk for a Linux user than it would for any kind of proprietary software. I think that's a message that we need to get out there, because there's been one, and it's only as of late, patent troll who's filed a suit against Linux. You know, patent trolls are actually much more common in the proprietary software world, and Microsoft has been the recipient of lots of these suits as well. So I think this is nothing new to open source. There's no greater risk here, and that's something that we need to communicate to users of Linux if we hope to be successful.
Well, thanks again for that answer. Just about exactly what I was looking for.
Great.
Let's move into some of the written questions, because I see we've got a number of people who seem interested in two or three common themes.
Sure.
You mentioned earlier in your presentation that from the perspective of the Linux Foundation, you see the future as being primarily two systems, Linux and Windows,
mm-hmm.
which sort of implies that you don't see any future for any proprietary Unix variant.
Are there some HPUX folks on the phone? I think that's probably a good question to ask. So, obviously, for today's conversation, I'm painting with a broad brush, but it's certainly a more subtle argument than that. I do see a continued future for proprietary Unix variants, but I don't see them expanding really beyond the various niche uses that some high performance and real time areas where proprietary Unix has done fairly well. I'm speaking specifically about mainstream computing and sort of even in that high performance and in markets where you've traditionally seen proprietary Unix, Linux increasingly becoming the dominant platform there. And the numbers really, really bear this out. You know, albeit the Unix marketplace itself is not declining at a precipitous sort of almost cliff-like pace, it's certainly not growing. It's not growing even close to the pace that, that Linux and Windows is growing. So I think there's still a role for those proprietary Unix variants, but I don't think it's going to be the dominant role in computing. And you even see companies like Sun Microsystems saying, hey, we'd like to open up our traditionally proprietary Unix platform.
So is it fair to say then that, that you see the role of proprietary Unix perpetuating, but at an increasingly smaller percentage of the overall market?
Correct. And in fact, I just, you know, I'm most greenfield applications today I'm seeing on Linux or on Windows. I'm seeing a lot of continual support of, you know, applications that were written on proprietary Unix variants, but I'm not seeing massive growth there.
Okay. Let's move on to the next question. You mentioned on a slide again a while back that you you had at least anecdotal evidence of a Wall Street firm that had spent a year trying to do a Linux migration. Can you give us some ideas of some of the problems?
Yeah, I mean, this is a frustrating one. It is a very subtle question, and the interesting part about it is, you know, these are differences in, you know, the compiler tool chain. It's differences in, you know, things like the C libraries that, you know, make the effort of having to go back to your applications and recompile all of them arduous. Those were some of the big differences. It was the file hierarchy, I think, in some cases was an issue there, but really it was around the C libraries that presented a big problem to them. And the need to go back and recompile and retest all of their applications was a huge pain for these folks. Fortunately, the Linux standard base has done a fairly effective job in bringing cohesion to the world of that particular library and those particular interfaces. But
it sounds like that's exactly why the Linux standard base exists, is to avoid problems.
It really does, and I think what I see from some of these companies and the stinging response that they're getting is, you know, a lot of these banks are on fairly old versions of Linux, and they tend to run these versions and resist change for many years. So what I think we're seeing here in these migrations is a weeding out of that, and hopefully as the LSB grows in scope and the amount of interfaces it defines and has higher quality testing environment, this will become decreasingly the case. But yeah, it's unfortunate to see these firms suffering from this. And I think the biggest message that they provided to me was, you know, hey, that we thought we were, you know, everyone said it was all about choice here. You know, and that just creates a real disconnect between what people thought was a benefit of migrating to this platform and the reality. And I think that we, as good stewards of Linux, and certainly as industry who makes money off the platform, need to align our promises with what we deliver. And so you see this renewed sense of urgency with the Linux standard base as a response to that particular issue.
That's a really good point, Jim, and it does point out the word you used was a subtlety, and it's an important one that maybe those of us who have been living and breathing this environment for so long, certainly from my own perspective, hadn't really appreciated fully. So that was an interesting new way of looking at this that I hadn't considered before.
Yeah, defining the binary interfaces of an operating platform is a relatively esoteric part of the technology industry, as evident by my wife's inability to tell anyone what I actually do for a living. But it certainly is something that's critically important. In this case, the Wall Street company is an example of that.
Okay. The next question is sort of related. It's along the same general theme, but it gets to the issue of how is Linux going to solve the problem that it continues to have, really, with the lack of proprietary drivers. I think the best example that jumps to mind for me is wireless on laptops.
Also to Linus Torvalds. He is don't ask him about his Broadcom wireless drivers. Not to call out an individual company, but certainly they're a culprit. That's a great question, by the way. I want to thank the person who asked that question. Device drivers is an interesting problem for Linux in that the kernel community does not want to have a stable device driver ABI for a number of reasons. And this has been often criticized by the creators of drivers as a problem for Linux. And what's been happening, and this is interesting for all of you to know over the past year or so, is that people have now looked at how driver support works in Linux and realized that the way that you support drivers isn't necessarily worse in Linux. It's just different in that as more market force is put behind Linux, more device manufacturers are interested in understanding how they can provide timely device support through the existing open source system. And that's something that we've been working with them and educating them on how to do. And let me give you a few specific examples of some of the work that we're doing there. And let me outline a couple of the challenges that we have. One of the things that you hit upon, Harry, is that where we have a lot of driver issues is on the desktop systems, where the number of drivers that need to be supported there is just an incredibly complex and mind-boggling number. And there's already an existing ecosystem and sort of methodology for dealing with them that people understand in the Windows world. We need on the Linux side to look at how to better service, to better provide tools and education for device manufacturers on how to write drivers for the Linux platform. And also how to take advantage of the community-driven process to actually have those drivers written and supported by the community. A few examples of that include Greg Crow Hartman's project, which has several hundred volunteers who are willing to write device support if provided with specifications by manufacturers into the Linux kernel at no charge. This is something that driver or device manufacturers just are simply unaware of that this project even exists and are increasingly becoming educated on how to write specifications so that these volunteers can create and support drivers on their behalf. In many cases, these manufacturers don't really have good specifications themselves. They just internally don't write these things very well. And one of the things that we're doing is working with ODMs in Taipei, places where lots of devices come out of, to educate them on how to work with initiatives like Greg Crow Hartman's and how to work with the foundation to get better device support on the market. I really think this isn't a technical issue in terms of the need for that there's some sort of technical hurdle to get better driver support for Linux. I really believe this is an educational issue to work with device manufacturers on whether or not they even want to have a proprietary driver or whether they want to take advantage of community support for the particular drivers for their devices educate them on how fast the Linux market is growing, and what you'll see is them actually providing that driver support themselves. So I think there's sort of a twofold challenge to that. But really that's something the foundation wants to tackle in terms of providing educational materials. And certainly Greg Crow Hartman's project is doing in putting their money where their mouth is and providing driver support. The final issue, and not to belabor this point too much, is I think one of the areas that we need to look at from the open source community and the Linux community is not only whether or not a device is supported, but whether or not a device is usable or configurable, even if it is supported. So, you know, and many times the response to driver support questions that I get is, well, that is supported by the Linux kernel. But if you have to go in and write custom scripts to configure that particular device, and where the Windows world has a very simple UI to go in and use a wizard to configure that particular device, I think that gap needs to be closed as well. So it's not only a presence of device support within the kernel, which I believe is really taking care of itself, but it's also a usability question in terms of being able to configure and support these devices just from a human interaction perspective.
So that's another good point. Well, while we're on the topic of proprietary, let me jump ahead to a question that's been put in here about how do you envision the Linux standard base working with embedded systems in the future? If you take as a given that embedded systems hardware has historically been closed and proprietary.
This is something that's interesting. So we're looking at creating profiles for different use cases for the LSB, whether that's desktop, server, mobile, embedded, sort of taking slices of the standard and then utilizing that to solve standardization issues that go across those sort of broad horizontal markets. The embedded systems industry is going, this is a really interesting question in that you're really seeing a change here. And in 2008, one of my predictions for 2008-2009 is that you are going to increasingly see embedded systems manufacturers who had traditionally written their own operating systems, supported them for 5 years and then kind of started over, or used Linux, fragmented it quite significantly, so deviated from the mainline or sort of the collective work so significantly that they sort of restart 5 years in sort of, they go down their own fork of Linux, and essentially it's like it's basically like supporting a proprietary version, and they have to restart 5 years from now. I think you're seeing them because so many of them are using Linux. Starting to understand and mature in terms of how they can benefit from getting things into the mainline kernel or in standardizing particular interfaces in user space. I think you're seeing them increasingly see the benefits of doing that as they want to control their costs, as they support more devices in the market. So what we're really looking at is creating profiles within the LSB to meet those market needs. But I think it's also just a matter of educating an entire industry on, what the benefits of getting things upstream, getting things into the mainline, and taking advantage of collective support really means to them from a cost perspective. In fact, I'll put a shameless plug-in for an interview that I did with Linus Torvalds that we're going to be publishing in January at the Linux Foundation, where he talks quite a bit about this sort of change that you're starting to see from these type of embedded systems companies and learning how to work within this new open source model that's relatively new to them. As the person who asked this question pointed out, has historically been closed to proprietary.
Forward to hearing that talk between you and Linus. In a related, actually, tangential question between the last two, what sprung to mind as you were talking is the TiVoBox. In fact, the fact that GPLv3 actually added protections that have been referred to as protections against TiVoization.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking the open source and, in fact, GPL Linux operating system and locking it inside a proprietary hardware mechanism that doesn't give you access to it. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I personally and the foundation and lots of folks who work within the Linux world don't have a huge opinion on that one. And let me tell you why. Our view of licensing and these type of issues is that the goal is to get as many people sharing in the process of developing software as possible. There's less of an ideological drive, so to speak, although there are lots of people who do really believe in the idea of being open and free, but also are relatively pragmatic in that, one of the complaints that you have about TiVo, for example, is that they're somehow getting a free ride or taking and not giving through doing this. And I don't think that they're completely a free rider, because obviously, you know, they're going to have bugs, and those bugs are going to be, you know, at some point propagated into the mainline just because they're a rational actor and they'll support that. So while I think that there's some in the free software movement that, you know, really see things like TiVo as a real threat, you know, we just don't put a lot of thought into it on our side. It's just not something that's a number one concern on the list of things that I think about certainly every day.
Okay. Well, thank you. It just struck me that between the proprietary drivers and the closed embedded hardware, it seemed like an interesting combination of issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key thought there for TiVo is, you know, despite the fact that, you know, they use this, you know, which essentially a checksum to prevent folks from modifying a system and then having it work on that particular box, they are in compliance with the GPL. And, you know, again, the more people who are out there using Linux in the systems that they're offering in the marketplace, and as long as they're complying with the current terms of the license, which is V2 for Linux now, I do think that that's a good thing. And, you know, we'll see how the license landscape shapes up over time. But I do think that you'll see a natural market mechanism that will have people realize that, in fact, sharing and allowing users to modify code is something that you know, is good for their business, that people want. And we'll see how that shapes up over time.
Hey. Another question here on the list is one that's important certainly to an enterprise as large as Hewlett Packard, but also to most Fortune 100, Fortune 500 companies, and that is, what role will enterprise security have in the future of Linux?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And, you know, there have traditionally been two major movements, SE Linux and AppArmor, in the in terms of security for Linux specifically. Well, the way I guess I would think about security related to Linux is, one, there are two very sophisticated frameworks that make Linux an extremely secure and reliable operating system. The second thing I think about there is, this is an area where I think if we have a standardized underlying platform, if collaboration is collectively taking place in areas where everyone agrees it's beneficial, what happens is you sort of elevate innovation into areas like security, which are sort of higher level of problems in some aspects. You sort of uplayer that innovation, and you start to see really interesting things come out of that uplifting of the entire development process. You know, there are companies, and this is where the enterprise is sort of on a leading edge in creating better and innovative security solutions that are based on that open source platform. So what I'm seeing in security is things like SE Linux, you know, increasingly getting to a higher level of innovation in the security that it provides. And certainly from just talking to banks and insurance companies and government, Linux is, you know, in fact, this probably happened a couple years ago, has really been deemed an equally secure system to almost any system out there.
Okay, we've got a hand up in the audience. I think Tim Chambers had a question for you. Operator, if we could bring Tim on the line for us, please.
Thanks. Jim, I wanted to follow up on a comment you made about TiVo. I've heard the observation you made about people thinking that TiVo is getting a free ride, but there's also another dynamic going on. If you compare TiVo to Myth TV, it's more along the lines of whether you're allowed to crack open the box and actually work on the entire system. And even though TiVo may be honoring the letter of the license for open source software, that they're starting a disturbing trend in the minds of several people, and I think that's best characterized by Tim O'Reilly's Make magazine, the whole concept of being able to void the warranty and modify your hardware. And I'd like to hear your reaction to that dynamic going on in the TiVo case.
Again, it's just for me and for I believe that to some degree the market takes care of that. In that, I mean, so Make magazine is a great example. Which is, if folks on the phone haven't read this magazine, I highly recommend it. This is just such a great. I made a sailing vessel out of bottle caps and old milk bottles. I'm being facetious, but this is a really interesting magazine. And what you're really seeing there is a category of consumers that want to be able to modify and play with these things. And so from that perspective, I think the market to some degree takes care of this particular issue. We just don't have a strong stand on this particular point. I don't think it does a hugely disproportionate amount of harm. And I think that, consumer demand, there will always be another company that can come out and produce a device that can be modified. I mean, TiVo's, it's not a monopoly. The set-top box market is competitive, and if people come out with a set-top box that can be modified, I think that the market will play that one out. But,
well, Linux Media Center Edition is one step in that direction.
Bingo. Exactly.
The hobbyists, and I also point out that if the car industry had evolved along these lines, I don't think we'd have had the innovation in cars that we did. It was only because the designs were mechanical and simple, and the owners of the Model T were able to break open the car and modify it and learn how it works and figure it out, and that helped the whole car industry. You had new companies started because people bought cars and said, hey, I can make one better. And I think the only difference between cars and computers is the level of complexity, that you don't have one individual who's able to work on a mechanical system or work on a computer the way they can a mechanical system. So it does take a community to do that innovation. But I think we've only hit the tip of the iceberg in open source hardware innovation. And for the foundation to take a neutral stand, as you said, I'd just ask you to reconsider that in the wider market of innovation. And that's where I think, even though Richard Solomon isn't our best ambassador for these ideas, I think he's right on in saying that people need the freedom to learn and understand how things work so that we can improve them and fix them when they break.
I agree with that. So to be very, very clear, I agree wholeheartedly with those goals. I think that they're incredibly important. I just think that in the world of licensing software, it's a pragmatic world where the developers who pick that license do it for certain reasons. And I think that the folks in Linux, really do it primarily to, share their code from a development perspective, but I don't know that they're necessarily as concerned, at least some, and again, this is a huge and diverse market of thoughts, and I don't speak for the community collectively, and I certainly don't speak for individuals, but I think there's lots of folks out there that don't see this as a problem and really see the goal of being able to share code from a development perspective as important, but not necessarily, the TiVo case as being all that damaging to that overall goal.
Fair enough. Thanks for your comment.
No problem.
Jim, we've got one more question here, and then I think we'll probably start to wind down a bit. But it's a follow-up to the security topic.
Yep.
And Robert Fritz asks, Microsoft has claimed that they do comprehensive security design review as a function of their software development lifecycle. What's the Linux approach to ensuring that an equivalent comprehensive design-focused security review is a fundamental part of Linux?
That's a great question. So first I would make a petty comment on the effectiveness of the software, the security design review that Microsoft has certainly had in security. I mean, they just, despite all of their review, have a fairly, for many people's standards, a fairly poor security track record. But I think that they are legitimately and in a meaningful way trying to improve that and do it through this design review process internally. The interesting thing about the Linux approach is that design review is happening in the open in the Linux community. You know, I sort of look at it as the equivalent comprehensive design-focused security review sort of happens in the development of Linux itself from an open source perspective. And while, albeit it's not a top-down design approach, the peer review really forces security vulnerabilities out of the system itself.
Okay, Jim, we're winding down, running out of time.
Great.
Here. Again, I'd really like to thank you for taking your time this morning out of what I'm sure is consistently a busy and hectic schedule. It was a pleasure hearing from you, and we would look forward to any future opportunity to work with you collectively or individually.
Great. Well, HP is an incredibly important member of the Linux Foundation. The work you guys are doing is really good for everyone. So I want to thank all of you for allowing me to come and share our thoughts with all of you.